Well, we are back to, we're continuing in Genesis, and tonight we're looking at starting at verse chapter 41. You remember we had, though, Joseph was in prison, and while he was in prison, two court officials, the chief baker, or the chief of the bakers, and the chief of the cup servers, the chief butler, if you will, came and after a while they had dreams. He interpreted them and said, in 3 days you're going to be back to Pharaoh. One will be executed, one will be restored to office. So the one who was going to be restored to office, the chief butler, remember, he said to him, when you see the Pharaoh, tell him about me. I'm here unjustly. Speak up for me. Please remember me. We asked the question, yet we noticed that the chief butler did not remember Joseph, but forgot him. And we were sorely disappointed at the chief butler. It was most disappointing. That's just no way to be. So, you recall, Joseph then was staying in prison. And actually, when we read Genesis 41, we find out it's 2 years later. As a matter of fact, 2 full years is sort of the way mine translates it. The New King James translates it that way and says after 2 full years, it literally means years of days. And kind of emphasizing when you see, think a year of days, it's emphasizing every day. It's just waiting way after a whole 2 years of days. At the end of 2 full years or years of days, Pharaoh had a dream. So, you might remember, what was the occasion that brought Pharaoh's to decide to bring the butler back and execute the baker? Do you remember what it was?
Birthday.
His birthday. So I think what we can gather, 2 years of days, 2 full years, it's probably around the time of his birthday, okay? So, while he's there and having his birthday celebration, apparently in that context, he has a dream. So here is the royal majesty of Pharaoh dreaming. You can tell he's dreaming because of the Z's that are coming up, or at least that he's asleep. I think I might have mentioned, by the way, Pharaoh is a title. Kind of like king. It literally means, in Egyptian, it means big house. And so that's why you'll see, it's kind of like, or sometimes we use Caesar. It's a title that, it's a title. And so that's why you'll have those Ramses, there's Tutankhamun, there are these other names that sometimes we think of, but they're called Pharaoh because that's more of their title. So there he was in his palace around the time of his birthday, 2 years almost to the day, or close to there, maybe to the day, 2 years full of days, he had a dream. And you recall in the dream, I hope you have a chance to read ahead, what did he see in the dream?
Seven fat cows.
He saw 7 fat cows, okay. Now, here's a picture from our source. And I want to go ahead and give a little shout out, or at least a speak out, to the source of a lot of these illustrations. They come from freebibleillustrations.com. I love the ministry there. There is no charge. You're free to use them. You can't sell them. But they gather, and they gather from various sources, these illustrations. And we're using them in a variety of contexts. I love how they're available. But this picture shows the cows grazing, all right? But I want you to notice what it says in verse 3. Behold, suddenly there came up out of the river 7 cows, fine-looking and fat, and they fed in the meadow. Here they are feeding in the meadow, but where did they come from?
The river.
The river. What river would that be? Probably the Nile, would we think? Does anybody have a translation that says Nile? Okay.
Yep.
Which translation is that?
Oh,
the...
I looked that up.
All right. What about any English translations call it the Nile?
Yes.
What English translation is that? Is that?
So what verse are we in?
Verse 2.
What
do you want?
This is
1 and 2.
Verse
1
and 3.
It says Nile? Mm-hmm. What's interesting is this is you know, to be honest, as I read through it in the Hebrew, and it's kind of an unusual, and then I looked and see how it's translated. I said, river? That's not the usual word for river. In fact, this word, means, it comes from the Egyptian word for the Nile. And so, whenever you see that particular Hebrew word throughout the Old Testament, it's specifically referring to not just a river, the river, it's really the Nile River, which is the river of Egypt, right? And so, why might that be important? Why is it important that the cows were in the Nile River?
That's the source of all the vegetation and everything.
Yeah, that's... I want to call it the food basket, but really not. But it's the lifeblood of Egypt. And again, if you want to take a look at a satellite picture of Egypt, I mean, it is sand, and a little pinch of green right down the middle. That's the Nile River. They irrigate, and so all of their farming is within irrigation reach of the Nile River, especially back then. And so it was their life, you know, they worshipped it as a god. It's their life source. So the cows coming out of the Nile said, you know, that kind of represents Egypt and Egypt's prosperity. And there were the fat cows, and they came out grazing in the meadow. And I just want to say, it's kind of typical, actually. It says that they came out of the river, tells us they were in the river. And it was common in Egypt for cows to want to be in the river because, a lot of people suggest that it kept the flies down and such. And so if you read through this chapter, it very much sounds like it's coming from Egypt, which it is. You know, Moses was born and raised in Egypt, and the events described here are Egyptian, but it just has a very authentic ring to it, the vocabulary and the description. So here are, and one problem here is there's more than 7 cows there. So this one, interesting, looks like a two-headed cow. This is downriver from a nuclear plant.
Why the confusion about Egypt? Would Pharaoh only have been from that area? You mentioned it suggests it might be Egypt. What, would there be any other?
Liberal critics always want to say someone else wrote it. It wasn't written by Moses. It wasn't. It's some later authors. You know, and so they like to say that the Bible was written maybe 1,000 years after the time of Moses. And so, and especially Genesis and all that, they love to divide it up into sources. The one struggle with that is, again, everything, like I said, the vocabulary, the descriptions, read like it's written by someone who knows Egypt, like Moses did. So it's not a surprise to us because we believe Moses wrote it. He lived in Egypt. But if you're a liberal, you know, they're always looking for, oh, this couldn't have been Moses that wrote this. But it just sounds like someone from Egypt wrote it, who knew Egypt. Okay, so that has that flavor of authenticity, which shouldn't surprise us because it's authentic. Okay? Anyway, so those are some cows, and I just want to mention, too, the significance of the coming out of the river, the Nile, is important, but cows are a big deal in Egypt. For one thing, they worship them. The cow god, they worship the moot, the cow god, and others. Many gods were represented as cows, and Pharaoh sometimes is a cow. Ra was represented. Here's a golden calf. Remember when the Israelis came out of Egypt, they worshipped a golden calf. Where did they get that idea? You know, from the Egyptians. The cows were a sacred animal because it represented the gods. But they also worked them, and so I just did quickly a search, and you can find all kinds of the ancient pictures where you'll see cows involved in either as being depicted as some form of deity or in the context of the work environment. But again, cows were very common there.
It's a little strange they could be deity and a work animal.
Yeah. That sounds strange to us. I guess the kid. Now that's a question. I'm not sure I can answer that question. If they ate the cows, yes.
In India, the males are the only ones who are put to work. Cows usually are not.
Ah.
Yeah.
So in India, is the bull considered sacred or just the cow?
Just the cow.
Just the cow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But this last picture, that's something that's very common. Mm-hmm. For cultivation.
Actually, I got this from India. But isn't that interesting? I mean, that looks perfectly authentic. That picture of them. And by the way, you notice the horn distinct. Kind of, sometimes you'll see these distinctive longer horns that in a lot of the pictures. So, did they eat them? That I cannot say for sure. But one reason they worshipped the cow deity. I'm trying to think on some of these if they were male or not. That's, I'll have to wrestle with that. But because it's a source of food, so that's part of it. Good questions. I'll have to do some more thinking about that.
You know, Paul says that you take a piece of wood and worship half of it and cook your dinner with the other half.
Yeah.
The wooden pole.
Well, yeah, Isaiah, for example.
Isaiah, yeah.
You make it for 1 minute it's a god and the next minute it's firewood.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I could have used milk for their cereal.
Right. There you go.
Cheerios.
It's really interesting, especially you can go back to pictures, especially around the 1800s, and it looks Egypt hadn't changed that much in its experience. I was there in the 1980s, and there was a lot that was still really very much like it would have been, the mud huts and that kind of stuff in many ways. Definitely things have changed more and more since then. So I saw that seven fat cows coming out of the river, the Nile River. And then he saw something that was really troubling to him. Along came these lean cows. And it said they were ugly and gaunt cows. And what was really weird about these very lean-looking cows, and here's another picture of them here coming out of the river, that's more graphic, isn't it? It just kind of shows you just how it was troubling. Matter of fact, when he's describing, when Pharaoh's describing his dreams later on to Joseph, he actually gives some more details. And one of the things he says is, I've never seen a cow like that. It was troubling to him. Do you ever have that where there's something about a dream that's just, that was troubling, my car only had two gears and it wasn't, it's awful. Whatever it might be, there's something that seems so out of, those cows just really, this is awful. And then something really, really weird happened. Do you remember what happened next? The lean cows ate the fat cows. You've seen cows at work in India. Many of you have been raised in the great state of Texas or lived here long enough to see cows being raised. Have you ever seen or heard of a cow eating a cow?
They're not carnivores.
And they don't eat meat either. So you can just imagine, sometimes with dreams, they don't, this doesn't work that way, And, but this was a troubling thing. These awful, troublingly awful looking cows, now they're eating the fat cows. what does it all mean? And so apparently he kind of woke up from there. And then it says, in verse 4, so Pharaoh woke. Verse 5, he slept and dreamed a second time. Suddenly seven heads of grain came up on one stalk, plump and good. Egypt has a reputation in the ancient world of being the breadbasket of the ancient world. Again, this is one of the things that Israel's told when they're going into the promised land. Your time in Israel is going to be different than being in Egypt. In Egypt, virtually always, you had a good water supply. The river. Okay. And in fact, sometimes in the seasons of heavy rains and such, it would flood. But that was actually a blessing. Why?
Fertilized.
Yeah, and it would bring up some good, you know, it would kind of refresh the fields with good soil and fertilizer and all that sort of thing. In Israel, there's the Jordan River, but you don't see, that's not really, there's the Galilee region, but really most of Israel is watered by rain. And it has two seasons, the early rains and the late rains, fall and spring. But that tends to make you much more dependent on the Lord to give us rain, where when you've got the river, it's just there. And so it's good, you know, so they were dependent on the Lord to give the rain. But anyway, one of the things about Egypt is because it had such these flat areas around the Nile River, they had a good grain, you know, they were the breadbasket of the ancient world. And so up comes this very abundant, healthy-looking stock. And then it's filed seven, you know, the next comes up, it says, here came, then behold, seven thin heads, blighted by the east wind, sprang up after them. In that part of the world, when the winds come in from the desert, they are hot, dry, dusty, and miserable. They have a couple of words to describe them, but the one of the words I would hear would be the chamsin. And that had the means of, comes from the Arabic word meaning 50. There's this 50-day period when these winds would come. And it would just be one of those things where, you know, you walk slow and feel miserable if you're out. It was just hot. Well, again, that's rough on the, and so that kind of this wind came, that's what these looked like they'd been blighted by a hot, scorching desert wind. And the seven thin heads devoured the seven plump heads. Have you ever seen wheat eating wheat? You know, so again, it's a strange dream, right? But it's very troubling. It's very troubling to him. So he awoke, and indeed it was a dream. You know, sometimes you wake up from a dream, and it's, am I dreaming? And sometimes you're a little annoyed because you woke up before, you know, the story was over. And you wonder, how's it going to play out? Woke up. So it came to pass in the morning, his spirit was troubled. And so he sent and called for all his counselors. Again, you see the same thing in the book of Daniel with Nebuchadnezzar, a troubling dream. Remember, they believed the gods communicated with the dream, through dreams. And so dreams were significant. But this one bothered him. It's like, what does it all mean? It's so troubling. And so we see here the counselors coming in, and it says they couldn't help him, right? He called in the magicians and the wise men, and Pharaoh told them no one who could interpret it for them. Let me just ask you to fill that out. What do you think that worked like? Did they all just stand there silent and say, yeah, I don't get it? What do you think happened? Mark?
They may have left to visit the prison.
Pardon?
They may have left to visit the prison.
Yeah, maybe some of them may have gone to go to prison, but do you think the advisors just, I think they probably made some guesses. You know, but apparently, you know, God just kept them blind, and some of them should be able maybe to figure out. But it was just so bizarre. Whatever they said, the king wasn't satisfied. He was like, that's not right. That can't be it. And so now he's disturbed because he's getting a message and no one can interpret it for him. But he just senses that this is significant. But they all look unable to help him. Then finally, remember, the butler remembers something. The chief butler spoke to Pharaoh, saying in verse 9, "I remember my faults," or literally my sins this day. "When Pharaoh was angry with his servants and put me in custody in the house of the captain of the guard, both me and the chief baker, we each had a dream in one night. He and I, each of us dreamed according to the interpretation of his own dream. Now there was a young Hebrew man with us there, a servant of the captain of the guard." So here was this Hebrew and a slave. So, I mean, we're talking, he's wrong ethnicity. He's a slave. He's a nothing. But we told him our dreams and he interpreted them. And what he said would happen, happened. So we, you know, in other words, I can give testimony. We had these dreams that bothered us just like you're bothered. Matter of fact, similar words are used. And this guy interpreted it. And here's the test. What he said they meant actually happened when he said it would happen. Well, you can imagine the king got excited and said, "Bring him in." And so the Pharaoh sent, called Joseph, and they brought him quickly out of the dungeon. Of course, if the Pharaoh is troubled and says, "I want action," you know, they ran, they worked. But it says, and he shaved and changed his clothing and came to Pharaoh. Typically, the Egyptians did not have beards. Now, if you think often you'll see Pharaoh presented with a beard, but most of them did not. Most of the time, as a matter of fact, that when you look at the ancient monuments, that's one of the clues. You'll see someone with long beards, and you'll say, "Oh, those are Semites." You know, those might be Chaldeans. Those might be Hebrews. But that's when you can kind of look at people and see where they're from, and they're and so the bearded ones typically are coming from their Semites. So he was shaved. Some suggest maybe his head too, and he was bathed. He changed his clothing, and Pharaoh said to Joseph in verse 15, "I've had a dream, and there's no one who can interpret it." So he was brought in, and he comes before the Pharaoh. Okay, following what we've been saying, and give me a sense. What would Pharaoh's normal reaction be to someone like a Joseph at this point?
Well, he wouldn't talk to him at all.
Why not? Why wouldn't he talk?
Because he's beneath him.
Beneath him, and, yeah.
Status.
He's not even a slave. He's a slave who's in prison. Let alone he's a Hebrew. I mean, this guy is at the bottom rung of society. But it shows you how desperate he is. These highly educated scholars of interpretation can't help him. I don't know, that might be like George is working on something at the dental school and he's trying to figure out the physics and chemistry of some of these things and he's just like, I've got to figure this out before I can really teach it. And so he goes, talks to all these experts, and they're like, I don't get it. And all of a sudden, one of the janitors walks up, sees what he's working on, and says, "Oh, here, let me help you." And lays it all out. And bingo, he says, "That's it. That's what I was looking for." It would be, your first question is, what are you doing here? It's like that, but even more. You know, here, the greatest of the great in Egypt are nothing, and the lowest of the low is brought to him. But you see, Pharaoh, he's heard enough. Okay, here's my dream. And so I like this picture here of him trying to lay it out before him.
Even worse, I could have called Drake.
Yeah, I would have made something up. Hold on, George. Let me think about it. Google and see. That reminds me, I went to my chemistry teacher who wrote the textbook when I was in college. And I said, you know, I'm really struggling here. And how do you study this? It's not coming together for me. Well, he said, well, you could really try to understand on a molecular level exactly, you know, how the electrons and all this kind of stuff, or you could do what I did. And I thought, here it comes. Here's what okay. What did you do? I just memorized everything. I walked out of there saying, I'm cooked. Well, anyway, so here he is. He's talking, and I love this. Here's this prisoner listening while the king of Egypt, he's partly king but also partly deity, he's a son of Ra in typical Egyptian thinking, is pouring out his heart to him. He said, I've had a dream. There's no one who can interpret it. I've heard and said, you can understand a dream to interpret it. And so Joseph answered Pharaoh and said, I love this. He says, it is not in me. God will give Pharaoh an answer of peace. Most of humanity would have seized that and said, this is my opportunity. I can become rich, powerful, famous. But Joseph's response is, oh no, I'm not the one who's doing this. It's God. He doesn't need me. God is giving you the interpretation. And I love that he isn't trying to seize God's glory. I remember hearing about a missionary in another country, and people would come and they would pour out their praises for things that he had done and things that had happened. And he was known often to mutter under his breath, Lord, take your glory. I don't want it. I don't want to touch it. Far be it from me to try and take God's glory. And that's Joseph. And so he's very careful at the ripe, ripe opportunity to give glory to God. So Pharaoh laid it all out to him. By the way, and I see that, and I'm reminded of my hero. There's Mr. Spurgeon. This is posing how he preached. So you know it must have been a good little sermon that Joseph let loose. So Pharaoh said to Joseph, behold, in my dream, I stood on the riverbank. He starts laying it all out, you know, and I saw the seven cows, fine looking and fat. They fed in the meadow. By the way, the word for meadow and all this, the fat is they were among the reeds. This is the papyrus reed. Again, very Egyptian. And you might recognize the word papyrus. That's where we get paper. It first came from these reeds. They would flatten them out, dry them, and cut them open, and the fibers put them out. It was really interesting. They would the fibers running crosswise. That would actually be almost like lined paper. But so they were feeding among the papyrus reeds. Behold, seven other cows came up with them. Poor, ugly. I've never seen in all the land of Egypt ever seen cows like that. The gaunt and ugly cows ate up the first seven of the fat cows. You can almost hear him maybe getting excited in a troubled way to Joseph. When they had eaten them up, no one would have known that they had eaten them, for they were just as ugly as at the beginning. And so I awoke. What's the significance there? When he ate up the seven, you couldn't even tell that they'd eaten anything.
They're still skinny.
Still skinny. What does that mean for the prediction that's coming about? Yeah, it's not like, wow, that was a really rough time. It took a big dent out of our, you won't remember that we had the boom before the bust. The boom will be forgotten. You know, so like maybe someone has really well into the market and, oh man, I saw this 7 year surge and my stocks went up. And then, oh, there was a bust and the bubble popped and I lost, 40%, 60% of my earnings. No, it'll be, you won't even remember that there were earnings. It'll be such a devastating time frame. So I woke in my dream. And, let's see, there they are. Yeah, there were the cows eating, and that was really troubling to him. Then behold, the seven heads of grain, and then the blighted grain, your heads of grain, thin heads, devoured the seven good heads. So I told this to the magicians. There was no one who could explain it to me. Verse 24 is what I just read. Then Joseph said to Pharaoh, the dreams of Pharaoh are one. You have two dreams, but really it's the same message. God has shown Pharaoh what he's about to do. That's an amazing thought, isn't it? This isn't the gods, you know, Osiris and Ra and some of these others. The true God has shown Pharaoh what he's about to do. Seven good cows are 7 years. Seven good heads are 7 years. The dreams are one. The seven thin and ugly cows came up with after them are 7 years. This is the thing which I've spoken to Pharaoh. God has shown Pharaoh what he's about to do. Indeed, 7 years of great plenty will come throughout all the land of Egypt. After them, 7 years of famine, I'm at verse 30, will arise, and all of the plenty will be forgotten in the land of Egypt, and the famine will deplete the land. So the plenty will not be known in the land because of the famine following for it. It will be very severe. And the dream was repeated to Pharaoh twice, because the thing is established by God and will shortly come to pass. So, so he tells him, lays it all out. It's what are your reactions to those things? I think you notice as we walk through the text, and as you've spent about 8 hours on it at home already this week.
Take courage sometimes to give you the bad news too.
No, it takes courage to give the bad news. You know, that's one of the problems we have sometimes is there's bad news and no one wants to tell the president. You know, this has been a problem over the various presidential things. No one wants to tell or other rulers. They're, you don't give them bad news. Some leaders discourage, don't tell me the bad news. Where a wise leader says, I want the truth, the whole truth. So it took courage to say, bad things are coming. What else strikes you?
Verse 10, it just popped to me that the cupbearer and the baker were put in prison for the offenses of their servants. It didn't pop to me before. Only when I read it here, I just realized. I thought they had committed some offenses, and that's why they were. But it says, when Pharaoh was angry with his servants and put me and the chief baker in custody in the house of captain of the guard.
I think what's saying is we're the servants he was angry at.
You think so?
I think so, yes. You know, we were just servants, but I think that's what he's saying is.
Okay.
I think. Could be, because remember, they were the chief. He was the chief of the butlers. He was the chief of the bakers. So it could be something beneath them that caused the problem.
Well, he believed him.
Who believed who?
The Pharaoh believed him when he told him the dream interpretation.
Pharaoh, yeah. You know, so, I'm speculating that his magicians and counselors did tell him ideas. And it was like, he just didn't, that can't be it. He hears this, and again, you know, the butlers made it very clear, I can vouch for this. He's hearing this and thinking, that's exactly, that goes along with what I was feeling. And again, you know, God was doing that to communicate to him. So, let's talk about some lessons here. What are some takeaways? What are some things that this chapter is of value to us? All scripture is profitable. All scripture is good for us. Now, of course, it was originally written to the Jews leaving Egypt and heading into the Promised Land. But what are some of the lessons we can learn from this? What are things you see here?
The providence of God was very evident in
said exactly what's going to happen, and I mean, he knew what was he was in control.
You can see God's providence, that he truly is in control of all things. Bart?
Same.
And he has a plan, and he's got a plan still, and he's telling us what's going to happen for us, too. So we should listen.
God has a... So does God no longer have a plan? God has a plan. God has told us where that's going to go. Our struggle is, it would be really nice if we had the same time frame. We actually, it's interesting, though, isn't it? We know how the last 7 years turn out. Mm-hmm. It'll be the lean cows. We're just not sure when that all begins.
And I think it's interesting that that's 7 years.
Yeah.
And ours is going to be 7 years.
So it shouldn't entirely, you know, God works in that kind of a cycle. So, yes, I was struck by the same thing. Here we are again, if you will, a 7 year period of tribulation, which, by the way, they were told that the bad times are coming, prepare. And, you know, Jesus said we're to not be caught, you know, unawares. We're supposed to not necessarily, we're not to stock, I don't believe we're supposed to stockpile for the tribulation because we're going to believe it's going to be out here, but we prepare by making sure we have a relationship with Christ. But yeah, God still has a schedule of 7 years. I was reading through this, I was thinking, you know, he told about 7 years of prosperity and that before the 7 years of poverty. Don't you know there are lots of investment people would love to have that kind of a, you know, if God would just lay out for them the next 14 years. I remember a friend of mine sent me a chart from the business page, and it showed a graph of a stock, you know, it's, you know, up and down. And what he did was he circled on the graph when it was the lowest spot. He said, buy here. And then he took it to the highest spot of the graph and said, sell here. Now, the trick is knowing, you know, you only see that graph after it's already passed, right? But he's graphing out 7 years. Well, here's some thoughts that struck me as I looked at this. I think we're tracking in the same ways. First of all, God is sovereign over all. And God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do. God is sovereign over all. So let's see where he said it. What was that?
25, 28. What he's about to do.
Yeah, verse 25. God has shown you what he is about to do. So that's interesting. The famine, as well as the poverty, as the prosperity, God's doing it. That's the hand of providence. God is working through in natural things, and that might be the water flow of the Nile drying up substantially. It might be right now in parts of the Middle East. I can't remember if Africa's included in that. There have been these devastating locust plagues. And that's the kind of thing, you could be the best farmer in the world, and they come in and they strip it bare. And that's not just, oh, that's bad for the pocketbook. That's bad, I mean, that's famine. So God is sovereign over that. And that's important. Joseph didn't buy into this theory that God is just as weak and helpless as you are. He watches it happen, and he just really feels bad about it. He said, God is doing it. God's in control. Point number two. I'm struck by this. God is gracious. He's warning and guiding Egypt. Pharaoh doesn't worship the true God. Pharaoh worships numbers of gods. Pharaoh claims to be God. And yet, in this pagan, immoral society, God has shown grace. And so that we call this sometimes general grace. God has a special grace for his children. But like when he sends the rain on the just and the unjust, here in his mercy, he is helping Egyptians. And really, through the Egyptians, all their neighbors as well, he's offering mercy
And grace, common grace, but survival to these pagans. I think that's an incredible statement of grace. Any reactions on that thought of you?
I think it's interesting. He could have chosen to raise up Joseph's family, right, to minister to these people, but he chose it the other way so their hearts will be open. You know, he gives them the grace to minister to Joseph's family. I thought that that was...
He could have left them in the promised land and brought the world to them.
Right.
Interesting. Good point. But he's going to have them in Egypt.
Because you're losing everything and you're coming as beggars to pagans who are prosperous.
Yeah. That's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
That God's people are coming and needing a handout from these pagans. But of course, the only reason they can get a handout is because God's people have been, says, you know, watch for God's hand here. That His providence is fabulous. Okay.
Oh, I'm Jacob's point. That has to be a humbling thing, a very humbling thing for God's people to have to beg from the pagans.
Yeah, a humbling thing for God's people to go to pagans to rescue them. Good point. Yes, Mark.
I was just thinking, do you think that Joseph would have reached out to, like, I know that he didn't necessarily talk to his family, but like, did anyone else look at Egypt and say, oh, they're storing a lot of food for the future? Is there any other nations that caught on, or did they talk to them, or...
You know, so Mark's asking, did other nations hear about this 7-year plan? I've been wondering, did Pharaoh even put out the word? Or did he just announce a new tax? Did he say, hey guys, we've got the 7 years and then I'm not seeing any evidence that Pharaoh let the message out, let alone to the nations.
And so you have to wonder what the Egyptians were feeling when they had to give all this extra to Pharaoh. You know, did they feel rebellious? Or
yeah, we're
they didn't know why.
And we're jumping ahead, but that's where it's going to lead, isn't it? To sort of 20% tax.
Right.
And I think, you know, is that really adequate? You know, when you know there's 7 years, you know, 20% of 7 years, you know, you almost think, oh, man, you should have made that. But they maybe not have griping as much because they were doing so well. I don't know. But you would, you know, who likes paying taxes? And all of a sudden, this huge tax is coming in. Wouldn't you know, isn't that just like the government? Just when they're really getting ahead, they up the taxes. Could have been something like that. I just wonder if he would have thought, you can't really control, if you let out all this information, you won't be able to control the situation. I don't know.
But didn't he control the situation all the time? I mean, they weren't used to thinking for themselves anyway. It was a socialistic government.
Well, there you go. Yeah, that's true. The whole governmental system tended to be, we'll tell you when you need to think, and that won't be anytime soon. Yeah, we'll tell you what you need to think. You're right. And so just this, whatever the government says. I think we're struggling with, we're kind of used to being independent and all that. And they were kind of, although there would have been grumbling, no one likes paying taxes.
Wasn't it Joseph's idea?
It was Joseph's idea. And so I'm going to take that as God's given wisdom. Some people critique it and say, well, you know, you'll notice what ends up happening is because of that tax, eventually the people sell themselves as slaves to the government. And so basically you end up with Pharaoh owning all of Egypt. That sounds like the plan of some of our presidential candidates.
Don't learn anything,
do yeah.
During those plenteous years that the land was bringing forth by handfuls, and there was a great abundance, so maybe it wasn't so burdensome. But, you know.
they might not have minded just because they were probably getting prosperity. You know, even after the 20%, we're doing better than we ever did before. And so you're right. Boy, it'd be fun to get through all the details and find out all that was going on. Yeah. So we see God is sovereign. We see God is gracious, even to unbelieving Gentiles. And sometimes we might say, well, wait a minute, should I ever be involved in charity to unbelievers and all that? Well, we see God's grace was there. But especially God is faithful to Abraham. And I'm mentioning Abraham, the Abrahamic covenant. God is preparing a way to preserve the nation. And at the end of the story, in Genesis chapter 50, Joseph says, God did all this to preserve his people. God promised Abraham that he would have descendants. And so God is moving internationally to preserve a people. And that's one of the things I love, for example, about the Christmas story. When God had to move Joseph and Mary, 75, 100 miles south to Bethlehem, he did it by causing attacks over the whole Roman Empire. And we all think, wouldn't it be better just call an Uber? You know? But instead, but that just shows God moved in the most powerful man on earth at the time, Caesar, to cause attacks to get them 100 miles south to fulfill a prophecy from the days of Micah. So God thinks in such massive ways, planning hundreds of years in advance. Remember, they're going to leave and be gone for 400 years in Egypt, moving all of the world in the Roman Empire to bring this about. But God is being faithful to his promise to Abraham. Zechariah calls them the apple of God's eye. And in Jeremiah, he says, the stars and the sun and the moon and the seasons will stop before Israel ceases to exist. And so God, we see God can moves mountains, moves the world at that time to preserve his people. And it continues to be, I remember who it was, but one of the one of the czars, I think it was before the communist era, said to one of his advisors, can you point me to one legitimate miracle? And he said, no problem. The Jews. How could this small little people continue to exist? And so God is faithful to his promises. God is gracious to all, to Gentile and Jew alike. He's faithful to Abraham, preserving the nation in a time of famine. He doesn't do it in the way we might want. Wouldn't it be easier just to send the rain and the abundance? But God moves sometimes in ways. Again, part of that is he wants to get them out of Canaan. And you know, sometimes someone will be all upset because they've lost a job. They have to relocate. And they're thinking, oh, this is devastating. You don't know what God is doing and his purpose and plan in that. That there may be something that he has for you, or maybe he's taking you all the way to that other distant land, like Oklahoma, for his divine purposes in a life. Oh, yeah, David.
I think along that line, even God's timing in, you know, the chief butler forgot to tell Pharaoh. He said, be sure and tell Pharaoh about it. He forgot, but God's timing was, if he had told him right away, I mean, he was primed with this dream to hear what Joseph had to say, and that might not have been the case at all if he had come up 2 years earlier.
You're right. So we can look back and say, what if the butler had told him? The Pharaoh might not have been impressed. We're just a Hebrew slave, so what? Or he might have said, oh, that's interesting, I'll let him out. And then he might have taken off, and they might have forgotten 2 years. But you're right, the fact that he was right where God could, right where Pharaoh could get to him. And again, poor Joseph at the end of his life can say, okay, I get it. The prison was the very best place for me. You know, you brought Pharaoh to me when you brought me to prison. The problem is, most of us don't get the full picture until, if we ever get the picture, until after our life is over. You know, it'd be so much easier if God just, you know, as we went along, sent us a little text and said, by the way, here's why I'm doing this. But we don't know. His sovereign, God is sovereign, he is gracious, he's faithful, and my final, God is glorified. God reveals and guides through Joseph so that God gets the glory. You know, because, you know, God is providing, but in particular, it was very clear. The Pharaoh had to, in a sense, humble himself to a Hebrew slave and unfold his heart. And that Hebrew slave became the second in command of Egypt, so that it's clear God is working through this Hebrew. And eventually that Hebrew God will rescue Israel and conquer the Egyptian gods in a few hundred years. But because he's working through Joseph, God gets the glory for anyone who cares to see. So those are just some of my thoughts in trying to figure out what's the big picture. And so the question for us is, how does this apply to us in our lives? The fact of God's sovereignty. God doesn't make mistakes. We may not know what he's doing, but he does. And so we can trust him. His grace and his mercy, and just wondering at that. When we go and, you know, we might gripe about the fact we paid a few dollars for an antibiotic or something and say, oh, this is... And I thank God. And think about what life was like before antibiotics. How different the world was. Some of us will have to have various knees and other things operated on. Think back to the days of Marshall Dillon. And who was the guy that had that terrible limp? Chester. And I look back to the medical care during the Civil War, and it's horrible. Thank God for the grace. You know the story, right? How, where penicillin came from. It's one of those. There's providence all over that. They were doing an experiment in microbiology, and unfortunately came in into the lab, and there was a contamination of some of the bacterial, the culture material. Fungus was growing on these plates, so it was contamination. But then he noticed every place where there was fungus growing, the plate was clear, meaning all the bacteria had all been wiped out. And he thought, this could be helpful. I have found something that kills these bacteria. That was penicillin. But that which has saved countless lives was discovered accidentally as a result of a lab failure, a contamination. You know, God's grace is just amazing, how he, his common grace, the gifts of medicine.
Wasn't that derived from wheat, from bread, the fungus itself?
I'm not sure.
Like a starch.
I'm not sure where it came from.
Have you seen green mold on bread from time to time? And I often wonder about that.
I almost had a heart attack. I took a course that included mycology, the study of fungus. Yeah. And one of the themes of the professor was, there's a fungus among us.
Yeah.
But anyway, we had to go and collect mold from our dwellings. And college students all had good access to mold. And so I got a piece of moldy bread, brought it in, and then you had to prepare a slide so we could identify it and all this. And I prepared the slide, put it on a microscope. And I couldn't identify. You know, you've got these various things to look. You can look at the structure, and that helps you. And I called over the graduate student, and I said, I can't figure out what this is. Could you look? He looked in the microscope. He gasped, and he ran away. And I thought, this isn't good. The professor he brought with him, it was interesting. He was on loan to the university. He was actually an officer in the military. You know, why did officers in the military have a special interest in microbiology? Anyway, he kind of came quickly, looked in the microscope, looked for a while, and then he started chuckling and explained it to the grad student. I said, so what's going on? He said, if that fungus was what I thought it was. We were all dead. But you just messed up the preparation of the slide. But I gave that poor grad student, he thought I'm dead because of some dumb undergrad. But all that has nothing to do with tonight's program. But when I think of fungus, I have to think about that. But God's sovereignty, His grace, is something we can rejoice in. His faithfulness to keep His promises to Abraham and His promises to us. God keeps His promises. Why do I know for sure I'm going to heaven? Because God keeps His promises. Not because I deserve it. And God wants to be glorified through our lives. He wants to use us in our interactions so that God gets the glory. So that people will look at us and think of our God. Remember, Potiphar knew it was Yahweh, it was Jehovah that was blessing his house because of Joseph. And that's because Joseph was giving, like he did, he was giving God the glory. And so, may we be a light and give God the glory. Any other comments? Yes, George.
Two things. One, R.C. Sproul would be pleased with that.
I think so.
The chalkboard?
Yeah.
Oh, the chalkboard, yeah. If I could only reproduce the squeaking sound. That's what I did. I needed to have a little audio on there.
And the breaking the chalkboard.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, when Joseph is called before Pharaoh, reminds me of Jesus telling his disciples, you get hauled before men, don't worry about what to say. I'll give you what to say. And so he did that with Joseph.
You may have heard, so Jesus told his disciples, when you get called before kings and judges, don't worry, I'll guide you. That's something I hadn't thought about. If you were being called before the king, I think my mouth would be dry. My palms would be wet and my mouth would be dry and I would be so nervous. God must have given him remarkable grace that he could speak so clearly and boldly.
Well,
he
gave him the whole dream.
Yeah. Yeah. Reveal the whole thing. Yes.
On a practical note, are there some tips to discern the significance of dreams that we might experience in today's time?
That's a good question. So what do we do with dreams today? I mean, are we to interpret them in that way? I think for the most part, when we see dreams in the scriptures, you see them really going to as God's mercy to an unbeliever. Pharaoh, Nebuchadnezzar, Pilate's wife, Jacob's father-in-law, Laban. I think Jacob and Abraham had dreams or had nighttime revelations. So there are all this. So I'm not excluding that, but it seems like it's a way of communicating when they didn't have a better source of guidance, and that would be the scriptures today. So the norm here is God will guide us through the scriptures. So I get a little nervous about trying to give us some thoughts on that. It seems like normally I would think when we get a dream, it's that tells us things that are in our mind when we. From the day or whatever it might be. And I've found that sometimes that, things I'm worried about working on, that's what I'd come up and dream upon. I'm a little hesitant to see divine revelation in our dreams.
In the end times,
Yeah, in the end times, it says there will be some of those kind of things. Yeah. An increase in that kind of a revelatory experience. Mark.
There's another passage in Proverbs that kind of brings a pickup when Pharaoh stands before the king and says, "Seest thou a man diligent in his business, he shall stand before kings, not before a mean or obscure man." I mean, God tends to raise up people that are doing what they're supposed to do.
Faithful, faithful, little trusted in much. And, if we want to, a lot of times people, I want to accomplish great things. We'll be faithful in the small and trust the Lord. And that was Joseph. And I think we can be too. Paul.
I'm kind of caught by the use of east wind in verses 23 and 27. East wind is kind of an unusual wind, and I think it's also used with the parting of the Red Sea. And I'm thinking, you know, the hand of God being involved in the east wind, that's unusual. That would demonstrate that he's in charge.
In Israel, it's not unusual that it comes. That's, you know, the cooler winds come in from the the west because of the sea. But you're right. In Egypt, I'm not sure that it would be as common. Normally, you would think of it coming in from the south is where a lot of times the desert winds come into Egypt. But that's an interesting thought. I think you're right. It's an east wind that splits the... That's a good thing. Yes?
In God's sovereignty, he had the butler and the baker have drinks.
Yeah. It's... And God can do that. God can do that.